Hello, this is Justice Radio, a weekly show on WMPG with your host, Linda Small. I'm the Executive Director of Reentry Sisters, an organization that specializes in helping women and girls return home from prison. And you can learn more on our website at reentrysisters.org. Today, we are speaking with Bay Love of the Groundwater Institute, an advisory training organization that helps people and organizations address root causes of inequity, find their ways to connect and share power to resolve complex challenges. So welcome, Bay. Thanks so much for joining us on Justice Radio.
Thank you so much. So glad to be here.
Yeah. So begin. What first drew you into this kind of work, helping people and organizations sort of see the deeper structural roots of inequity?
It's a funny question. It's one that I've sort of looked at. It's like, what really got me here, you know, as I look back at my life and the different turning points to see if I can understand exactly how I got here. So I can share some of the key points, you know, but it's a whole bunch of factors that sort of come together. One major factor for me was that 9/11 happened when I was a freshman in college. So I had just gotten to campus. I grew up in Maine, but I was at school in Connecticut. I had just gotten to campus. 9/11 happened and this buzz started across campus and people were saying, this is going to change everything. And then over the next year and a half, I watched the United States sort of, you know, come and go and back and forth and right and left about were we going to go to war or not. Ultimately, the United States invaded Baghdad. And I had friends who were in the military who were part of the first waves of the United States entering, you know, Iraq and Baghdad, and then, you know, later being involved in Afghanistan and other places. I felt the war very personally that way. I also felt it very personally because when the United States went into Iraq, I was living in Germany. I was reading the German press at the same time as I was, as much as I could, reading the American press about the war. And I realized that the story as it was being told in Germany was very, very different than the story as it was being told in the United States. And that hit me like a ton of bricks because I realized that for all my life, you know, I thought I was getting a pretty objective, well-rounded view of history and politics and what was happening in the world. And that really made me realize I wasn't, which started a whole process of inquiry about why. Why are we going to war when a lot of the United States citizenry was saying they didn't want to go? You know, why did my buddy end up in the military in a war that he ultimately would say that he didn't even really believe in it? Why was the story being told in Germany so different than the story that was being told in the United States? And so if that makes sense, that led me down a cause of trying to look for root causes, you know, or what I came to call structural causes.
Right. That's a really great way to introduce how your life experience, you know, that moment where you discover that perhaps we're not always as upfront as we are in the supposed free press, and that inequities are systemic, right? And not just an individualized situation that gave you a broader view. And I love that, Bay. I think that's a great explanation and sort of plays right into my next question. Tell us about what the metaphor of groundwater means. What is that representing?
Yeah, absolutely. I can connect it back. I mean, to the story that I just shared, I ended up sort of having that moment, this, I'm not being able to see the whole picture here. Trying to figure out then how does one live a life where one tries to prevent that kind of thing from happening? Such what I felt like was intense and unnecessary violence, you know, that was having an impact on folks from the United States and folks, of course, you know, in Iraq and in the Middle East. But all of that questioning led me to New Orleans, Louisiana, after I graduated from college. And it was my time in college and in New Orleans that really brought this question of racism to the fore, because Hurricane Katrina and what it did to New Orleans seemed to put sort of U.S. racism out in front of all of us in technicolor, in a sense. Yeah. I mean, people locked on their roofs or stuck on the roofs for days in a major U.S. city, you know, almost dying of starvation and dehydration, you know, at a time when we could literally get a soldier from the middle of the battlefield in Baghdad stabilized in a hospital in Germany in 24 hours. I said, how could this be?
This is a great analogy happening,
you know, in Europe and the Middle East. So I really got interested in this question of racial inequity and sort of came to believe the same thing about that I did about war and power and how those things worked, which was, as you said, it was structural. It was systemic. For my whole life, I hadn't seen that. It was hard to see. I mean, it was, you know, I'm a white kid that grew up in Maine. For all intents and purposes, I grew up thinking racism was mostly over. And then when I started to see it wasn't all the way over, I started to think of racism as something that was primarily individual or primarily, you know, it's about bigotry or about attitudes. You know, my experience in New Orleans and my sort of study and the conversations and the community organizing I was involved in started to show me it was structural. And I was asking myself, how do we show that this is structural? Because that's a really important thing for people to know. Because if you're trying to fix bigotry, it leads you to one kind of action. If you're trying to fix structural inequity, it leads you to a whole nother kind of action.
Right. Yep.
Right. So how do we show people that it's structural? And the metaphor comes from that. And it was sort of adapted from a mentor of ours, Nelson Johnson, in Greensboro, North Carolina. And people should look up Nelson. He passed away just the past couple of years, but incredible man who I was lucky to spend time with later, in North Carolina, a lot of time. But Nelson used to tell the story about the fish and lake, and we just extrapolated it to include the groundwater. But the metaphor goes like this. It says that if you come out of your house and you have one fish floating belly up dead at a lake in front of your house, it makes sense to ask what's wrong with that fish. Can we fix it? Can we rehabilitate it? Does it have hope? How can we help it? But if you come out of your house to that same lake and half the fish are floating belly up dead, now the question is, what's wrong with the lake? And around racial inequity, gender inequity, socioeconomic inequity, all these inequities, we often blame fish for their lot rather than looking at the system that's causing people to have the outcomes that they have. And when it comes to racial inequity, since I'm with you today, you could look at the criminal justice lake or system, so to speak, and you could say, look, there's a pattern here. There's something going on with the way the system is set up lake. But the reality of racial inequity in the United States is that it's not like coming out of your house and one lake has half the fish floating belly up dead. It's like you come out of your house and 10 lakes all have half the fish floating belly, right? Because the criminal justice lake, is there racial disparity? Yes. Gender disparity? Yes. In housing, is there disparities? Yes. In healthcare, are there disparities? Yes. In transportation, are there? Yes. I mean, you could go to any system and see the same inequity. And you say, if you came out of your house and saw that, you would stop asking yourself, what's wrong with the lake? And you would start asking yourself, what's wrong with the groundwater or the system that connects each of these different systems? And it's helpful because if you look at the planet Earth, it turns out 90% of the water is not above the surface in the lakes, rivers, and streams where you can see it. It's below the surface in the groundwater. And so systems that seem disconnected actually are connected.
That is so profound. Thank you for walking us through that, Bay. And what a great analogy. And I know for a lot of our listeners, when we're talking about abolition and justice, we see those interconnected systems all the time. So if you've been impacted by the carceral system, you're also involved generally in family policing systems, and employment is an issue, healthcare is an issue, housing is a huge issue. And so we definitely see eye to eye on this idea of groundwater, because it is mostly invisible until you're experiencing it yourself, right? You either do that reflective work where it's right in front of your face and you can't ignore it, like your experience when you were in NOLA, or you live with it every day. You're under the thumb of that every single day. So that's pretty amazing. Thank you for helping, our listeners understand that. And so when we're looking at that, how does Groundwater Institute sort of put this framework into practice when you're actually working with teams of people, communities, and organizations? How do you present this? Do you present it the same way you just did to us now?
It depends a little bit on the environment where we are. In some places we can talk more directly about certain things, and places we have to talk a little more indirectly about these things. But one of the things that we have done as the Groundwater Institute is to try to make the case that we have a structural or a power-based problem. We would say the problem is power imbalance, because the people that have bad outcomes in one arena have bad outcomes in every arena. And people that have good outcomes in one arena have good outcomes in every arena. And that to us is an indication that there's a larger power structure at play. And to say that openly, works well in some situations and not in others. So what we try to do as the Groundwater Institute is figure out how to make that argument by using a lot of data, using a lot of history, and in a very objective way, or as objective as we can. So often what we'll do is, work with organizations to look at data that are important to them, and sort of line them up to show that inequity exists across systems. Then we show that typically that the inequity isn't only explained by socioeconomic status. That's one of the biggest things that comes up with race. People go, well, is it really that there's racial advantage and disadvantage, or is it just that, that group of people has more money and that group of people has less money? And so we can show that it's not equitable. I mean, even when you have the same socioeconomic status, there's still racial gaps. That would be true of gender, right? The same would be true of sexual
That's
orientation.
right.
Socioeconomic status can protect you, but it doesn't eliminate the other inequities. So we show that. And then we show that people really are treated differently by these systems. Examples abound in the criminal justice system, right? When you look systematically at sentencing, there are disparities. When you look systematically at how people are treated while they're incarcerated, there are disparities. You look at, I was thinking about this with the state of Maine. When you look at the racial demographics of people who are behind bars in Maine versus other states, there is a correlation often between sort of brutality and inhumanity of those systems being more inhumane in places that are less white. And that's not to diminish the inhumanity and the brutality of places or experiences of people who do have a certain kind of advantage, but it is to acknowledge there's something else that's also afoot. So that's what we do, is we come in and try to make that argument with data that works, with those systems. And the goal of making that argument is then to help people align their tactics and their strategy to be effective. Because our point of view is, if you have a lake or a groundwater problem, no amount of fixing fish is going to solve it. You got to change the lakes, the groundwater. You got to change the systems and the power structures that are underneath it. Otherwise, you're fixing fish, throwing back into the lake, and every time you throw them back into the lake, they end up with the same issue because you haven't fixed the cause.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's so important, sort of tailor your approach to the organization. And as you were talking about racial disparities in our mostly white state, you know, we have the sixth highest racial disparity in the way we incarcerate our Black and Brown brothers and sisters, which is atrocious because that means we lock up more Black and Brown folks than 44 other states in this country, which is astounding to me and also embarrassing for our state. And then when you talk about power differential, there couldn't be anything larger than an incarcerated person and their captors, right? There couldn't be a larger difference in the power structure there on the inside for people who are currently incarcerated. And that tends to follow you on the way out the door as well, when we're talking about systemic inequities in terms of all of the things that we talked about that affect you in life. So you are listening to Justice Radio with your host, Linda Small. And today we are speaking with Bay Love of the Groundwater Institute about his work as they help people and organizations address the root causes of inequities. So, Bay, you know, you have this, I saw it on your website, it's 1.5 days immersive experience. It's one of your flagship programs. Can you kind of tell us, you know, what does a participation in that look like? And what do you hope that that experience shifts in the way that people either interact on a daily basis or change fundamentally how they are in the world and how their organization operates?
Absolutely. Our immersive experience is 1.5 days. We offer it online. So if people want to come, we offer it online once a month, and you can dial in from anywhere as long as you have good Wi-Fi and experience that for yourself. And would love to have any of your listeners, Linda. We also have been doing a series of that work in Maine in person. And so we hope to have some more of that coming soon. We're looking at another session in December. So if people want to join for that, we'd certainly welcome people. Primary goal of the workshop is really to help people be more effective change makers. Our primary audience is really people who are about making change. Now, that could be leaders in a huge Fortune 500 company. That could be people who are involved with Reentry Sisters, who are, you know, every day getting up, you know, helping people, supporting people, and working to change the root causes of these, you know, inequities and the inhumanity that we see. You know, we say this thing probably too much, but that's that diagnosis determines treatment. So people that are trying to make change, you got to make sure you have the right diagnosis, because diagnosis determines treatment. If you have the wrong diagnosis and you give a treatment for the wrong diagnosis in medicine, that can actually be malpractice. You know, if you have a heart problem, you don't want to come into the doctor and the doctor gives you medicine for your liver, because goodness, the liver medicine could actually make the heart problem worse or make you sick in all other kinds of ways because of the side effects. So the workshop is about change making, help people make change more effectively, primarily by diagnosing the causes, you know, of the dysfunction and the inequity that we see. That's sort of the primary goal. But I would say the secondary goal is that many people find themselves in the workshop really wanting to understand, why do we have the inequity the way that we do? Why is race in particular such this third rail, difficult topic, you know, to get our arms around? You know, it seems to be in some ways tearing the country apart. Historically, it certainly has. Get our arms around. And the workshop can be like incredibly transformative. People, it was for me, you know, and I would say that it's not always that you learn new things. It's not all new, but at very least what it does, it takes things that for me that I knew A, Q, R, B, Z, and it lined them up A, B, C, D, E. So I could get my mind around the whole picture of how this all came into being. And I would say that one thing that distinguishes our work, I think, from some other, you know, race-based work is this key insight that in our view, racism really came about when white was created as a concept. And we always go back to, if you look at Christopher Columbus, 1492, right? He didn't identify as white. No one identified him as white. He didn't identify as blanco. He didn't identify as anything that has to do with race today, because race is a concept didn't exist, not in the way that we know it today. It was created at a particular time for a particular purpose. And our view is it was created in order to divide people who were working together. The best way to divide people was to actually take one group of a people that were working together in solidarity, take one part of that group, give them slightly more advantages than the rest of the group, and then create a narrative or a justification that said the reason they have slightly more advantages is because they're better than the other group.
Yeah, the whole divide and conquer. And we see that in the carceral system as well.
That is the essence of what we try to teach. And we think that's incredibly important, because even as I'm speaking here and we're talking about racial disparities and they exist everywhere, yet that's true. And that doesn't mean that white people, aren't also subject to incredible struggle. I mean, the reality is, even in spite of the white advantage that white people may have gotten or did get and do have, as a result of racism, that does not mean that white people don't struggle. Most white people have struggled since the very beginning of the concept of white, and we think that's still it. So we try to take analysis of racism that allows people to see the inequity, but also see the ways that the inequity was created for the specific purpose of divide and conquer. So the most important thing we can do is understand that, deal with the inequity in a way that allows us to work together, because as have-lesses, as people who struggle in one of the wealthiest ecosystems in the world, most of us, regardless of racial classification, are losing out.
That is so true. When we look at the political landscape today in particular, a lot of people are struggling. What think holds people back or organizations back from moving beyond sort of the traditional diversity statements to actual real systemic change? What are the barriers?
Oh, I think there's so many barriers, and it's been so interesting because I talked about going to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. That was a time, it was 2005, 2006, and I remember thinking, boy, systemic racism is on full display. This is a turning point. I thought, this is a turning point in American history. We'll never be able to go back on this. And then sure enough, a couple years went by, and it was like the whole conversation about systemic racism and structural racism that was happening post-Katrina sort of like faded off into the background. And Trayvon Martin was killed, and it sort of rose up again, and then it sort of faded off. And then Michael Brown was killed, and it sort of rose up again, and then George Floyd was killed, and then it was raised up again, and faded off again. And then, with this recent election and the incoming administration taking a point of view that talking about even the realities of racial history is somehow anti-American or somehow tearing us apart, I think has put us in a situation where what's preventing people from doing the work is a slightly different set of things than it was in 2010, if that makes sense. I think, 10 years ago, I think most people, including myself 10, 20 years ago, had no idea about the racial history of this country. I mean, I went to good schools. I didn't learn it. We didn't have the 1619 Project back then. You can love Ibram Kendi or you can have problems, but hey, that book Stamped from the Beginning is brilliant. And it lays out a whole bunch of history with primary documents, about how racial ideas were foundational to how our country and our society was formed. People we found didn't know that, didn't have that background. I would say now more people know that and have that background, but it's very difficult to figure out how to engage with power structures. They're large, they're forceful, they're complicated. I hear it so many times, Linda, now it's like, well, I'm overwhelmed, by the size and the scope of this. I think that is part of what keeps people from going all the way there with it. I think another, one, it's difficult to get your head around. Two, when you start to get your head around it, it's overwhelming. Three, all of our incentive structures are set up to reward people for fixing fish, not for changing groundwater.
One.
If you're on a program, how do you get reimbursed for it? How many people did you serve? If you help 1,000 fish, you can get more money than if you help 100 people. Set up yourself to change power structures. It's very difficult to measure, right? And very difficult to get paid for it and therefore to get incentivized for it. Not to mention, I think what we're feeling now is power by its nature, well, according to Frederick Douglass, right, would say that power concedes nothing without demand, that this is going to be a struggle. And so if you're helping people inside an inequitable power arrangement, no one's really going to bother you. Some people might say those people don't deserve to be helped, right? We got a lot of that going on now. But if you
Yeah, we
start to
do.
if you but if you start to challenge the power structure itself, you're going to feel the pushback of that power structure. And I think right now people are feeling that in ways, my goodness, at least in my lifetime, like we haven't necessarily felt, right? You could be censored, you could be doxxed, you could be accused of something. And so I
Oh,
think
funding's being pulled left and right.
so in that sense, I think all of those things orient us away from doing that structural groundwater power building work. And part of the work that we do is try to help people in their organizations, in their communities. We say, define your rightful role, which is, okay, you run Reentry Sisters, for example. You have a very clear argument about why doing power-based work is important for you. For a Fortune 500 company that is in manufacturing, it's a harder case to make, but they got to make the case. They got to say, this is why we're doing it, why it's critical to our business. Diversity improves the bottom line. It's the right thing to do by our employees. There are markets that we can sell to that are not, we have a purpose for the business besides just making profit. So in some of those harder to reach places, we're trying to help them generate the narrative that says why they're important. Then people got to do the hard work of building a team. There's power numbers, and too many people we think try to do this alone based on that their thinking is right. Well, it doesn't really matter if your thinking is right. What matters is, do you have buy-in behind what you're trying to build? Do you have the relationships and the trust necessary to do that? So we work with people on that. And then we think about the strategic steps for people to take. And all of that work, Linda, is about working with people to try to move from wishing they could do something about power or that kind of deeper change to really being
Yeah.
able to, because it's not an easy transition to make. And it's not that we have it all figured out, but we think we've got something to add.
Yeah. And I ask you, either for yourself or someone you've worked with, what's been one of the most surprising and meaningful insights that have come to light in this work that groundwater has been doing? Has there been like sort of an aha moment you want to share?
Yeah, I would say that. Well, I'll share one that's more recent and then one that's a little older. The more recent one is that I have a mentor. I was talking and I was saying something. He started shouting at me from the side of the room. He said, "You have to win, Bay. You have to win." And I thought, that's so frustrating and obnoxious. Why would you be shouting that to me? I'm talking about structural racism. How do you win that? And I really thought on it. And what I realized is it's really important to win, because I come from a tradition in which we would always say, you got to maintain hope. Like that's your job as like an organizer and activist. Like you got to maintain hope so that other people can have hope. Yeah, hope is an inside job, but hope is also, I think, a result of doing things and seeing the impact that we're making. You know, what you said, yeah, coalitions are hard, relationships are hard. So when we do something together, let's count it as a win. No, like let's do things together, count it as a win, feel it as a win, because we live in a time where people that I talk to feel like we can't work together. We're too far gone. There's too much disagreement. They're too far on the other side of whatever issue than me. If we can win some things together, even if a win is, heck, we didn't get such and such a thing passed, but we got more people out to speak on behalf of that thing we want to get passed than we've ever gotten, that's a win. And that matters because people feel it. And I think that hope is developed little by little, crumb by crumb, inch by inch. Because I used to feel like, well, why don't I feel more hopeful? Or, you know, do these wins matter if, you know, structural racism is still in place? And, you know, my belief now is that they do, because this is how does social change happen? You know, I have a friend who says, well, it happens all at once and it happens one little step at a time.
That's so true. I mean, at Reentry Sisters, our sisterhood, we always talk about celebrating our accomplishments, the big and the small, and also sharing in our sorrows. And I think it's so important to count those wins. And when you're talking about systemic change, at least from the legislative and public policy, I mean, you're talking years, right? Very rare do you put up a bill and boy, it sails right through and signed by the governor. That is just like does not happen. Good example is parole. Years down the road, right? Coming back again in January. These are things that you know already moving forward that we're just going to create more public awareness. So the next time we come to the table, we have more people standing behind us saying, yeah, we agree with that. And I think it's so important to take a longer view of things. We live in a society where it's just we want everything, we want it now, right? We got microwaves. We don't want to wait and save for something. We want to buy it and put it on our credit cards and on and on and on and on, right? So I think taking a longer view is so important to be realistic in the work that we do. And it also shores us up in the rough times where we're just like, oh, one step forward, three steps back, but that's okay. We anticipated that. And we're still shoulder to shoulder while we're taking those steps back. And there's really nothing wrong with that. And I think the other thing that I like about what you're saying when you're talking about the collective and we're blaming the fish is that we still, many of us have this mindset of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. There must be something wrong with you and not systems for, right? Blaming the individual for where you are because we're an individualist and not a collective society here in the US. And I think that is also sort of a roadblock in some of the work that we do. And I'm so glad you brought up hope because that was going to be one of my questions about, sort of looking ahead. What gives you hope right now?
I'll tell you one thing that gives me hope is sitting there last night and watching the results come. You know, and I'll talk specifically because I know it's one that's important to you all too, is the amendment that was introduced to, you know, basically prevent absentee voting, sorry, in the state of Maine. It's like, wow, we beat that back and absentee voting is still going to be available. And that's what I mean. That is a win. And I can't speak for anybody else, but I saw leadership in a whole bunch of corners where I hadn't seen it and where I hadn't felt it. And my hope went up in part because we won last night, right? You know, I went and I had the ability to knock on some doors with some people. I saw them come out. You know, I saw brilliant younger people, you know, who stepped up from all these different organizations, you know, to get out the vote and understand why this is important. I heard people that I've never heard see connection between voter suppression and the desire to curb absentee voting. I saw people making the connections.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And so it's interesting in a sense because I'm thankful for all the people that did that work and created the opportunity. I didn't set up the canvassing, I didn't set up the doors, but other people did so that I could go participate in that. And so it's actually, I don't know, that's a lot of where I draw my hope, Linda, is in community and seeing other people step up to the plate and creating opportunities for me to be able to step up. And that really fortifies my hope. It's good to be able to look at history. I get a lot of hope from history too. I think about Hurricane Katrina. After Hurricane Katrina, the way that people rebuilt their lives in the face of incredible devastation. Wow, that gives me hope to think about that, you know. Hanging out with a number of you all, right, who have spent time, you know, behind bars and seeing the way that you all have built what you've built, you know, in spite of that, that gives me hope. So it's historical, it's present day, but a lot of it comes from community and being in relationship with people and seeing people's hearts and determination that keeps me
Yeah,
going.
that's a beautiful thread you just created, sort of past, present, moving into the future with resilience, right? Collective effort. And the fact that it's multi-generational, which is one of my biggest forms of hope, is as we pull next generation, some younger folk into this work, that at some certain time, I'm not going to be here to see the change that I would like to help create today, knowing that somebody's going to pick up this work and carry it forward to its eventual fruition. So I think the multi-generational aspect is really a hopeful piece for me as well. I love that. So, Ben, I have one more question for you. Totally wide open. Is there anything that we did not cover that you would like our audience to know? And you could do a little commercial break in this as well and tell folks what your website is if you want to, in addition to whatever you have to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, our website for the Groundwater Institute is Groundwater Institute, all one word, groundwaterinstitute.com. So please do check that out and be in touch if there's anything that we could do to help you if you're interested in our work on that. And I would just say that, like, as I think about my life trajectory and where I'm at, like, one of the things that I want to do, Linda, in the next years and decades is stay in Maine. And I'm blessed to probably, you know, they should be able to stay here. My family's here and everything. And I want to build power in Maine with people that have values like Reentry Sisters has, and you know, so many people that I'm able to work with. And I want us to have power that is in service of humanity and in service of love, like Dr. King talked about, Martin Luther King, because he would say that power without love is reckless and abusive, but love without power is sentimental and anemic. And so I just want to, you know, say to all of your listeners, you know, thank you for listening. Thank you for having the space for me to come share some things today. And if you want to be part of, or if I can be part of what you're doing in a way that advances us building power in service of love and the value we espouse, count me in.
That's great, Bay. And your name says it all, right? Which I also love. We're just reminding you, folks, we're here with Bay Love today, and we're talking about power in service of love. And I just absolutely adore that. And so, listeners, thank you so much. We have some exciting new shows coming up on Justice Radio. We're going to talk about legislative process, how you can become involved in that. We'll talk about some main organizations who are envisioning justice, survivorship, and accountability in multiple different ways here in the state of Maine. So please visit Justice Radio on our show page on WMPG.org for archived episodes aired on WMPG, WERU, and WMHB. And a big thank you to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode of our series.